Podcastle, episode 487 for September 12th, 2017. A Whisper in the Weld by Alex E. Harrow. Hello and welcome to Podcastle. I'm your assistant editor and host, Setsu Uzume. Podcastle is very proud to present A Whisper in the Weld by Alex E. Harrow. The story originally appeared in Shimmer. Alex is a part-time historian with a full-time desk job, a debilitating rereading habit, and authorial ambitions. She and her husband live in Kentucky under the cheerful tyranny of their one-year-old. Her most recent story, The Autobiography of a Traitor and a Half-Savage, is available on Tor.com. Narrating this story for you is Stephanie Morris. Stephanie Morris is a professional fangirl by day and the lone library assistant staffing a college circulation desk at night. She has narrated short stories for Pseudopod, Podcastle, Escape Pod, Cast of Wonders, and Starship Sofa, guest blogged on subjects ranging from book recommendations to zombie turkeys, and performed Shakespeare in a handful of weird churches. Until she suppresses her inner perfectionist enough to create a website, you can find her on Twitter at @smaliamorris. And now, put on your gloves, punch in, and enjoy the story.
A Whisper in the Weld by Alex E. Harrow. Issa died in a sudden suffocation of boiling blood and iron cinder in her mouth. She returned to herself wearing a blue cotton dress stained with fresh tobacco. She was younger and leaner, as she'd been when she'd first met Leslie Bell. Her skin shone dark and warm without the black dust of the mill ground into it. After death, ghosts are sculpted like cold clay into the shapes they wore when they were most alive. Some people are taken awfully by surprise. Women whose whole lives were about their husbands and homes are, without warning, precisely as they were when they met a stranger's eyes on a crowded streetcar. Men who had the kinds of careers that involved velvet-lined train cars and cigar smoke are suddenly 9 years old, running their spectral fingers through the tall grasses and thinking of nothing at all. Issa wasn't surprised by the blue cotton dress. She had always known what she was about. She came back to herself with a feeling like hot wire being drawn through the dye and the rusty gravel on the west side of the Sparrows Point steel mill. She was disoriented for a moment, used to seeing the mill like a distant map below her from the top of Betty the Blast Furnace, the glowing arcs of welders and the arterial railways pumping coal and ore and sand and coke through the mill, and the distant rows of clapboard homes where her daughters waited for The Adventures of Superman to come on the radio at 5:15. The foreman was coming up the road towards the mill with his white arms resting across the shoulders of two young, dark girls, Issa's children. Oh, she hated the weight of that arm on her daughter's perfect shoulders. Vesta, tall, brave Vesta, who fried eggs every morning for her little sister before school, walked like a person who had lost the trick of it. Effie's oversized lunch pail banged against the side of her leg with every step. Their faces were like stones, or the faces of children who have lost their mother and father and seen the red-hot maw of the world open up beneath their feet. Issa already knew, but her daughter's faces told her she was truly dead and could never hold her children again. The rage and pain and wishing away of it swallowed her whole, and she lost track of herself for a while. Ghosts don't linger much. A few days of strolling through the world, which is much too loud and bright, then the dirt calls them down to trickle amongst the low, burrowing things to lose the boundaries of themselves in the rich smell of rot. Some stay, in the name of love or vengeance, but most people are pragmatists at heart and lay themselves down to rest. Issa lingered. Leslie used to call her mule-headed. Some parts of herself frayed and tattered when she died, the taste of grits with molasses on them, the way her daughter's tight braided hair felt beneath her palm, but not the mule-headedness. That first night, she stayed so close to her daughters they felt a constant humid chill down their necks. She walked beside them as they returned to their home, identical to 100 other homes in Sparrow's Point. A single dirty box with a bare bulb dangling in the center, a leaky parlor stove in the corner. She touched the tears on Effie's face with moth-wing fingers. She followed Vesta to the back stoop where, unwatched by her younger sister, she beat her fists on the stones and tore her tight braids loose. When her children finally closed their eyes in the center of the rope bed they shared, she lay down and slipped her arms around them. Effie shivered and burrowed further beneath the blankets. Issa told herself she would only stay through that first terrible night, but Dawn found her in the kitchen running frictionless fingers across the parlor stove, wanting badly to fall into the morning rhythm of coal and cooking. She pulled at the stove door, but she was a breeze blowing against a rusted iron mountain, and it remained closed. She pulled harder. The faint edges of her fingers frayed and spooled, half slipping into the door, and she felt every humped weld and fractured seam in the parlor stove before it creaked obediently open. She ripped away from it, reeling, and her other hand landed in the bowl of eggs on the counter. Beneath her weightless palms, the eggs rotted in their shells. She did not touch anything else that morning, but huddled on a kitchen chair, remembering the sweet slipping away of her hands into the iron, feeling both fragile and dangerous. Vesta rose and fixed breakfast, casting suspicious glances at the open stove and the faintly graying eggs. When her sister set a tin plate of grits in front of her, Effie burst into sudden loud sobs. "Effie, Effie, listen, honey." Vesta sounded so much like her mother that Issa's hand shook. "Persephone." The occult power of her full name stopped her. Vesta sat and pulled her sister's gangling legs into her lap and spoke to her in a tone that no 15-year-old should have to use and no 9-year-old should have to hear. "Listen, Mama and Daddy are both dead and it's just us two girls left, but we can't sit around and bawl about it, can we?" Effie's expression said she didn't see why not. "No, we can't," Vesta continued. "Remember what Mama did when they came to tell us about Daddy? She made biscuits and swept the floor and combed our hair. And then she'd gone to the common privy and vomited until she had nothing left in her but bile and despair. Some of the neighbor women fluttered as though they might say something, but she bared her teeth at them like a feral creature, and they'd all remembered things they had to rush home and tend. That's what we're going to do. We're going to pack our lunches and go to school and come home and make beans and ham for dinner." And, because they were each trying so fiercely for the other, that's what they did. Issa stayed in the house. She couldn't wash their dishes or fold their nightgowns, flung across the bed with the abandon of children who hadn't yet realized there's no one left to pick up after them. But she could murmur to Effie's cat, a slinking, ugly animal that only a 9-year-old could think was pretty, alternately named Lord Snowflake or Dust Bucket, depending on the quantity of coal grit in his fur. He wound himself around Issa's ankles, purring with the conviction of a former stray. He didn't seem to mind that she was dead. Cats have never seen the allure of the dualistic philosophies that plague humans, and some of our most cherished divisions, between right and wrong, life and death, rodents which are acceptable to kill and songbirds which are apparently not, seem rather arbitrary to them. She stroked him and pulled her thoughts away from the dark southern earth that called her. In the early afternoon, Issa went to the edge of the bay and waited for Leslie's ghost to come home to her across the ocean. She wondered if war had changed him, and if he'd died with one of her letters in his breast pocket. Yellow-gray steam boiled out of the mill and hung over the Liberty ships bobbing in the bay like deadly toys. She saw the ships the way a surgeon might see a person, looking through their steel skins to the skeletons of beams and welds running through their bodies. Issa wondered if the men who went to war saw the labor of their wives and sisters and the steel around them. She wondered if their labor was winning the war and saving their soldiers, the way the posters said, or if it was all just coal tossed into the ravenous belly of war. Leslie did not come. She went to the bay every afternoon for days or maybe weeks. Time is a humped and lurching thing for ghosts. Effie's cat followed her, genially acknowledging the other ghosts they passed. Issa recognized some of them easily, but many of them were unfamiliar to her as their past selves. Few people were at their best in Sparrow's Point. Most of them had traded away the smell of summer rain on the fields for the heat and stink and incredible noise of the mill town, on the promise of a regular paycheck. Most of them dreamed of going home. Isa dreamed too, during the long nights when she lay weightless beside her daughters, but ghosts only dream of the past. She dreamed of her first day in the mill, hired because the foreman liked the way her shoulders pushed against the seams of her dress and the unfashionable shortness of her hair.
"Just about like hiring a man, isn't it, sissy?"
He clapped her on the back and led her to a group of other new women and spoke to them all about the war and the state of the nation and the sacrifices everyone had to make. He handed out aprons and warned them that long hair, nails, and jewelry were safety hazards. Isa touched her locket, a tarnished heart containing 3 ebony curls of hair, and tucked the chain beneath her collar. At first, they put her in the black places below the ground, shoveling coal. She became a sweating, muscled beast in the center of a labyrinth, trying to shovel her way out of the dark. Her dreams of that time were scattered and clogged with coal dust. Moving up to the top gang was rising out of the underworld into spring. "This here is Betty, the biggest blast furnace in the East." The woman training her was short and gap-toothed, with dark rings around her eyes where her goggles sat. Later, Isa would find out that her name was Mary, and she was from Lewisburg, and her twin brother was a mess man on the USS West Virginia, and they would be friends.
"Listen, this is the truth. Betty Grable might keep our boys happy when they're over there with nothing but a couple of pinups, but our Betty is the one that saves their goddamn lives."
Isa could tell it was a worn joke, but Mary was proud of it. She worked years on the top gang, climbing up and down Betty's vast, mini-tentacled body twice a day. They kept the vents clean and the charger rolling and skimmed the flammable dust off every surface. They couldn't speak to each other, with their faces buried in the rubber and metal of gas masks and the roar of the furnace deafening them, but they learned to read the language of each other's bodies. When the wind blew the smog out over the bay and cleared the sky, when she and her team worked in a perfect dance of sinew and iron on top of the world, Isa was happy. Often, Isa dreamed of Mary's accident, Mary leaning over the hatch of the northernmost stove, hauling it open, a sheet of blue-white flame, Mary's screams just audible over the mill's grinding thunder. Mary came back to work with her left arm a black and pink mass of lumped scar. One-handed, she was only good as a tin flopper or a record keeper. Isa met Mary for lunch on her first day back, and neither of them said a word about it. The foreman strolled by and thumped Mary on the back and told her she was a real trooper, and left a moon pie on the bench in case she was homesick. Mary unwrapped the pie from its filmy plastic, then she crushed it, methodically, beneath her boot. She said, calmly,
"God damn them all to hell, Isa. They want you to think we're serving God and country, and an old white man who sure as hell ain't any uncle of ours. But we're just serving Mr. Eugene Grace and his 10,000 foremen, always patting us on the goddamn back and calling us his girls. And do you want to know the pot that eats me up at night? Soon as my brother comes home, they'll boot me and my bum arm right out, and I'll never see a fair wage at the top of Betty again."
Isa didn't say anything.
You already know it. I know you do. This place swallows us whole and spits out bones."
The rest of her dreams were of Leslie and the girls when they were young. Leslie did not come. If Leslie could have come to her, he would have. It wasn't something Isa believed about her husband, the way wives believe their husbands never look at other women or won't drink up their paychecks, but something she knew about him and her and the shape of the thing between them. It was like knowing which way was north, or how much milk to add to the biscuit dough. She worried that death in battle was different, and Leslie's ghost had been ripped asunder. But steel was war, too, and her death was surely no less violent and fiery and brave than his. Or maybe he'd gotten lost in the unfamiliar shapes of a foreign landscape. But Leslie never got lost. If he could have come to her, he would have, and no oceans or continents could ever have stopped him. And so, no matter what those typewritten letters had said, shining up from the page like tiny, blackened bones, Isa knew her husband wasn't dead.
The rush of elation and deepest sorrow almost unmade her. And oh, how sweetly the earth whispered to her, tempted her. But she snatched the fraying edges of herself and ran. She had always been long-legged, but now her steps ate up the ground in the weightless bounds of a doe. She passed children playing unattended on their stoops and laundry hung out to dry, absorbing the hot stink of coal smoke. Then she was outside the school, a sagging clapboard rectangle at the edge of the white neighborhood. Children poured down the steps. Vesta held Effie's hand in hers and did not look left or right. Issa fell in beside them, reaching reflexively to straighten their stiff collars and tuck away stray hairs before she stopped herself. "Vesta and Persephone Bell?" The voice was clipped in northern. A white woman in a brown khaki dress stood in front of the girls. Everything from her square handbag to her narrow eyes said she had the authority of state behind her. Vesta regarded her with a flat, unimpressed stare which, if she hadn't been 15 years old, would have sliced right through the woman. She only readjusted her round glasses. "Your parents were Leslie and Isabel, residents of Turner Station on Sparrows Point?" The past tense jarred Issa, but Vesta nodded. "I'm Mrs. Patterson. I'm here to speak with you about your future now that your parents are at rest. Would you both please step back inside?" Effie interrupted in a dangerous, chirpy tone that Issa knew very well. "Oh, Mama and Daddy aren't resting anywhere, Miss Patty. Both their bodies got burned right up." The woman blinked. "Well, we don't know about Daddy. They said he was missing after an air raid. But Mama died cleaning the dust out from under the blast furnace. Couple 100 pounds of red-hot dust came down on her. Poof! We didn't get her body neither." Issa felt a sudden depth of sympathy for the state worker, whose mouth had fallen slightly open. In a certain mood, Effie could provoke preachers to cuss and sweet-natured dogs to bite. The woman gathered herself and ushered Vesta and Effie back up the steps into the school. Issa drifted after them, a worried shadow in blue cotton. The trio arranged themselves around a teacher's boxy metal desk. The state worker explained to the girls that it had taken a while for their situation to become clear to the office because their mother's death wasn't reported in a timely fashion. But they were legally orphans and couldn't continue living on their own in company housing. They would come with her into the city to live as wards of the state. As a younger girl, Effie would be sent to St. Mary's. "Ma'am, it seems to me that some of your facts are wrong." Vesta's tone was mature, cool. "I turned 18 in March, and I'm Effie's next of kin, so we don't need to go anywhere." Vesta was tall and broad-shouldered like her mother, and a few hungry years in her childhood had taken the roundness out of her face and limbs. She passed easily for 18. The woman squinted at her and ruffled through her folders. "I'm quite sure we have your correct age down in our records, Miss Bell. And since when do 18-year-olds go to school?" "Well, I never had a birth certificate because Mama had me at home on the kitchen floor, so I don't know that you do have my correct age down in your records unless you were in Pulaski County, Kentucky in 1926. Issa rested her insubstantial hand on Vesta's shoulder. Vesta sat even straighter. "And I got held back in school. I didn't learn real well." "Clever Vesta. It was never hard to convince white folk that you were stupid." "Well..." Miss Patterson's ruffling continued, increasingly random. "Well, that doesn't mean you get to keep living in worker housing, does it? That's for workers, isn't it, Miss Bell?" "Yes, ma'am. I work at the mill 4 nights a week, sorting scrap." The lies tripped off her tongue with military precision. "Now, I thank you kindly for your time this evening, Miss Patterson, but I've got to get home and start supper." Vesta pulled Effie with her out the door and left Mrs. Patterson in her folders in the empty classroom. It was hard, that night, for Issa to keep herself from spooling away. Leslie would come home soon and take care of their girls, and she was so very tired. But the grim line of Vesta's jaw as she stalked out of the school and the stubborn way she held Effie's hand kept Issa rooted, waiting. She made restless circles through the house, trailing her fingers across familiar objects, almost dissolving into the delicious warp and weft of Leslie's favorite shirt folded on the dresser. Vesta got out of bed when the whistle blew for the end of third shift. Effie curled into the warm place she left. Vesta pulled on her mother's coveralls, still stiff with grime, and buttoned the collar below her chin. They were big on her, but not much. She tied a faded yellow kerchief around her head, scribbled a note on an old envelope, and left. Vesta paused to pet the cat curled on the stoop, but his eyes followed Issa's spectral shadow hovering behind her. Vesta frowned over her shoulder, but saw nothing. A sound had begun in Issa's head like a klaxon or a scream. She no longer had a pulse, but it beat in her temples as she followed Vesta along the rutted road to the mill. She joined the stream of workers pouring toward the punch clocks and pushed with them against the third shifters still trickling out. Issa was nothing but a chill along their backs and a flash of despair. Vesta found the foreman's office and slid inside.
"You're Isabel's oldest, aren't you?"
He was unsurprised.
"What can I do for you?"
His eyes sketched the strong outline of Vesta's shoulders with something like greed. Issa stepped between him and her daughter. Neither of them noticed. "Mr. Everton, I'd like to take my mama's place in the mill, if it's open."
"Well, now it might be. But not for anybody scared of hard work or girls who can't tough it out. We make steel here, and steel is war."
There was something unshakable in his voice that reminded Issa of the preacher back home, except the foreman's gods were profit and progress and the roar of the ceaseless mill. "No little girls here, Mr. Everton. I'll work." He told her to show up for the second shift and talk to a woman with a crippled arm on the main floor. Vesta left, while Issa's ghost ripped through the foreman's office like a furious, feeble tornado. A few papers fluttered gently off his desk. In a last flash of futile hate, she ran her hands over his stash of canned sardines and chocolate bars. They rotted in their wrappings.
"This place swallows us whole and spits out bones." Rage no longer possessed Issa, but perched heavily on her shoulder like a red-eyed crow. Plenty of young girls went to work when their fathers were at war, and their mothers were dead or sick or busy drinking and trying to remember why they'd ever come to this terrible yellow-gray town on the bay. Plenty of girls did it, but not Vesta. Not Vesta, who had read her mother's copy of Metamorphosis in fourth grade and whispered the stories to her sister beneath their quilts. Not Vesta, who cried when her father took the smaller portion of beans and gave her the last of the milk. Every woman in the mill was somebody's child, but Vesta was Issa's child. Issa would be damned if any child of hers would work in that mill. When Leslie came home, he'd find his two daughters whole and healthy and still in school, unscarred by the spatter of welders or the slower poisons of gas and steam. That was the reason for all of it. Why else had Leslie and Issa gone to war with the world, trading away muscle and blood and the late summer smell of tobacco curing in the barn, if not for their daughters? Hate and fear sent some people to the front lines in blast furnaces, but love sent far more. The dirt had been waiting for Issa for a long while now, and it was growing impatient. It sang her songs about moss and loam and the sweetness of falling apart. But Issa was listening for a different song, a song that groaned and grated in a thousand iron voices about never-ending shifts and coal trains that never stopped coming. She knew it very well, had heard it waking and sleeping since she left her home in Kentucky. It was the steel mill's song, and Issa leaned into it. She pretended it was the good earth she sank into instead of a city of machines. She let herself fray and slip away, remembering the way her hand sank into the parlor stove. The blue cotton dress tattered, and her long legs grew thin and faint, and then she was nothing at all. When she opened her eyes, she was the steel mill at Sparrow's Point. Her blood vessels were railways pumping coke and scrap. Her skull was made of brick offices and punch clocks. Her lungs were heaving combustion stoves. Her bones were ore. Her heart was Betty, beating and burning at the center of the machine and across her skin in every organ. 10,000 men and women toiled. Every skittering spark from every welder permeated her. Mary leaned against her on lunch break, struggling one-handed to unsnap her apron. The foreman clumped among the women in his heavy boots. All ghosts operate under the same set of laws. They have a short time to exist, a voice that can't be heard, and an uncompromising terminus, much the same as the living. But laws last precisely as long as people follow them, and not a second longer. Every now and then, out of desperation or desire or pure mule-headedness, somebody stops following them. So Isabel didn't go down into the clay and minerals beneath her feet. She became a steel mill. Amid the grinding and roaring vastness of her body, there wasn't much left of Issa the woman or Issa the mother. But there was just enough that she worried for the 10,000 people inside her, working in the soot and steam for their families. They would never leave, because Issa the Mill was a city that never truly slept, a city that required an army of men and women every hour of every day and unceasing thing. So, Issa the Mill ceased. She had died once before, and was familiar with the seizing of organs and limbs required. All the hundreds and hundreds of motions of the mill stopped. Trains drifted to a halt in the middle of their lines with their engines gone cold and black. Molten slag ceased to flow from the casting coals, and orange-hot metal turned dull and ashen in its vats. Crane loads of scrap hung suspended in the air as though they'd forgotten where they were headed. People boiled out of her like ants from a nest. At first, they shouted and swore, mostly at each other, but then a fearful bafflement settled over them. Cautiously, they tried to rekindle fires and flipped switches on and off, but Issa stayed still and dark. It didn't take very long before the company became aware that it was paying a smallish city of people to stand and stare. Everyone was crushed through the punch clock and sent home with instructions to listen for the whistle. While the foremen called their bosses and the bosses called in experts, Issa became the ghost town of a mill. She was tired the way only a ghost who has stayed too long is tired, and forgetting herself in the smell of coal and iron. But Issa remained a woman who got on with things, and knew if she simply drifted away, the mill would reopen in a week with an apology to the Defense Department for missing their projected quota. Issa wanted it to never open again, even if it put her neighbors out of work, even if their families suffered long, hungry nights, even if Sparrow's Point fell into rot and decay without its mill. And so she tore herself apart, bolt by bolt. She began delicately. Support beams cracked, welds fractured, mortar grew weak and powdery, as though the mill were failing a dozen safety inspections all at once. Then she gained momentum. Vats and stoves burst and poured out their lavas of molten tin and aluminum and pig iron. Fires caught in perfect synchrony across her body, and she blew out her coal dust breath to make them higher, hotter. Issa made of herself a grand pyre, for Mary and every man and woman swallowed whole since the first flame caught in the first engine. At the very last, while the heat turned her body to slag and ash, she burst her own heart. Betty the Blast Furnace poured herself out in a cloud of blue sparks and poisonous gas. Issa hoped Vesta and Effie saw the orange glow as they sat together on the stoop and knew their mother loved them. Issa wasn't anything after that. She slept in her own ashes and hardly heard the boot steps over her or the muttering of engineers and contractors that came to rebuild her, only to find that the project was too expensive and none of their survey stakes stayed where they left them. Eventually, they left her alone to rust. No one visited her except aimless children, who picked through her for treasures, goggles with cracked lenses, 1,000 scraps of metal warped in fantastical shapes, a burnt black heart that might have been a locket, and sometimes an ugly cat who liked to lay on her sun-warmed iron. Mostly she rested, as weeds grew up through her bones and mice made homes in her skin. And then one day, the faint reverberation of a footstep she knew as well as she knew her own heart rumbled through her skeleton. With a groan of wind over an abandoned field, she woke up. Leslie limped through the knee-high ragweed, her husband home from war and looking for his wife without knowing he was looking. He wasn't the way she remembered. War had sapped the humor from his face and mapped unkind lines around his mouth, but he was whole. All the thistles and dandelions growing up through Issa bloomed at once, out of season, in a riotous bouquet. They turned their mauve and gold faces toward Leslie, beckoning. He smiled the shadow of his crescent moon grin.
"You always were stubborn, Issa."
Smoke and grief roughened his voice. He told Issa about their girls and how tall and smart they both were, and the job he had directing ships on the bay. He told her about the war, and how men died without a bullet ever coming close to them, and then came home and walked around just like live people. He told her about the telegram printed on cheap paper he had read in a French hospital bed that told him his wife was dead, and how he had still expected to see her, somehow, when he came home. Then he sat down in the flowers and put his face in his hands and wept. Issa sipped the delicate salt of his tears through her dandelion petals. She thought some of it was for the loss of her, but mostly it was for himself, facing the endless labor of going on. She watched the tiny muscles moving across the backs of his large hands. She'd always loved his hands. She began to unwind herself from the taproots and tangled wires that pierced her. It was hard work. It was baling hay all day after a long night up with the baby and no hope of sleep the next night. It was a double shift on an empty belly. But she'd never shied away from work. With the very last of her strength, she pulled herself into a single shape. She became again that moment when she was most alive, in the sweet green of a tobacco field in August. She'd straightened up from slicing the stalks and shaded her eyes and seen Leslie for the very first time, drawn by the early evening sun like some ancient idol made of muscle and sweat and white teeth flashing. It wasn't falling in love so much as falling into place, perfectly, and seeing the whole future in the shape of his shoulders and knowing it was full of hurt, but knowing, too, that it was worth it. For a stolen second so small that time might not notice its pockets were lighter, Leslie saw her as she had been in that field 17 years ago, young and broad-shouldered and taller than him, wearing a blue cotton dress stained with sweat. Issa kissed him once, or perhaps a salty breeze blew across his cheek, and she was gone.
And welcome back. Alex said this story came to her upon seeing a Rosie the Riveter Halloween costume. She notes, "Our collective image of World War II is a collage of technicolor lies about the glory of war and the dignity of factory labor and patriotism and apple pie and that apple-cheeked kerchief-wearing Rosie pumping her fist in the air. If you ask people when America was great, this is what they think of. But the real Rosies were statistically working class, immigrants, and black migrants from the South. And the real factories they worked in were dangerous, ravenous, man-eating machines, much like warfare itself. History is more brutal, cruel, and unjust than most of us know. To misquote Orwell, it's a boot stamping on a human face forever. But it also exists because people, even the smallest and most forgotten people, have always been fighting back." Thank you for those thoughts, Alex, and for this story. That was our show for this week. On behalf of everyone at Podcastle, our audio engineer Peter Wood, our forum moderator Aussie Cat, and your editors Jen Albert and Khalida Muhammad Ali, along with our associate editors Aidan Doyle, Arun Jiwa, Crystal Claxton, Matt Dovey, Raj Gopal, Eleanor Wood, Stephen Capps, Stephanie Cox, Devin Martin, Elora Gatz, Julia Pat, Hamilton Perez, Naru Sundar, and Suyi Davies Okungboa. Thanks for letting us share another story with you. This is Setsu Uzume, your assistant editor, and we'll be back next week with another tale. Our closing quote comes from Bertrand Russell, who said, "War does not determine who is right, only who is left."